Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording, and it is 3 p.m., and that is on Friday, January 20th. And that's Central Time. And today, of course, being Friday, it's the big picture, long term audio and video for the various different asset classes. Now, I thought I'd kick off with the MSCI Emerging Markets Currency Index because we had a beautiful trend in emerging market currencies, and that particularly got going after a period of not doing much for a few years around 2002. And then that index more than doubled by the time it got to a peak in 2011. So we had a good sized shakeout in 2008. But then, because of the weakness of the US dollar in response to quantitative easing, the index popped straight back up on the upside and made a new high by the time we got to about 2011. Now, it's worth then considering what happened in 2011. Well, first, there was the big rebound off the lows in 2008. And then we'd had all of this money printing. And by the time we got to 2011, there was a lot of people were really concerned about the potential for inflation. And the Tea Party movement gained a lot of traction in the USA. And they started arguing about budgets and trying to pass these amendments or trying to pass rules about balanced budgets. And they largely succeeded in curtailing the spending ambitions of the second Obama administration. But more importantly than that, the dollar steadied. And not least because the US economy was starting to come out of the foreclosure crisis. The technology sector was just beginning to get moving again, and the stock market had just broken out to a new all-time high. So there were a confluence of factors around 2011 that both helped to support the dollar and stock markets. And we then also had continued rounds of additional new money being printed every time there was a wobble in the stock market, a wobble in the economy. The Fed intervened. They didn't raise rates for a long time. They kept printing money. Now, the emerging markets, by contrast, they went through a difficult period because commodity prices came down and the pace of China's infrastructure development moderated. And you can only build so many high-speed railways. You can only build so many shopping malls. And then there was the beginnings of talk about the deterioration in the quality of Chinese growth and the reliance or the beginnings of reliance on debt financing. And we've been through a very long period where that has been the case. Now we had the pandemic, and during the pandemic, emerging market currencies lost value relative to the dollar. There was a siphoning of money out of the rest of the world into the USA, and there were a couple of reasons for that. The first was that the technology sector was far and away best positioned to benefit from the pandemic, and the work from home, the evolution of cloud infrastructure, all of those types of companies did spectacularly well in 2020 and all the way through to the beginning of 2022. Then, with inflationary pressures rising, the Federal Reserve has been more aggressive than anyone else in raising interest rates. So that has helped to support the dollar. So, with that background, let's then look at the reality being provided by the chart now. So, this index has been going sideways for almost 13 years, and there's a very mild upward bias to trading over the course of the last 7 years. So, now let's zoom in a little. We've had a very impressive rebound And we saw the first evidence in here this week of a little bit of tiredness. So it wouldn't be at all surprising to see at least some pause and consolidation here for emerging market currencies. But then let's just zoom back out again and look at this period in the run-up, or I guess ahead of the run-up, from about 1999 through until about 2002. It didn't go anywhere, and then we had this clear breakout. Now, the question, of course, is what's going to happen next with the US dollar? There are significant arguments on both the bullish and the bearish side. But in order to have a clear, big bull market in emerging markets, you need the currency to go in your favor because it is the primary reason why people will, I guess, think about it this way. Most people have a clear home bias to investing. By that, I mean that most Australian investors will invest in Australia first. Then they'll think about investing somewhere else afterwards. In the UK, people will invest in a UK listed asset first. They won't think about investing abroad until after they've invested at home. And that bias is doubly powerful for US investors. Their capital market is so much bigger. And they've got by far the largest of the stock markets and bond markets. So then the necessity to go abroad is lower. In order for US investors to make the decision to go abroad, then they need a very clear rationale. Well, the clear rationale would be that the dollar's going down, and if you don't invest abroad, you're going to lose purchasing power. Or you don't invest in an alternative asset, you're going to lose significant purchasing power. And that was certainly the case in 2000, or particularly after 9/11, because the dollar trended down, and emerging markets really took off in terms of growth. So we had this phenomenally large move in currencies where emerging market currencies doubled in value. And at the same time, then stock markets also went up a lot. And one of the best examples of that is if we just redenominate the Brazilian market into US dollars and then zoom out. Because between the turn of the century and the peak in 2011, that index from that low in 2002 went from 2,300 to 45,000. So we're talking about a phenomenally large advance. And that was on the back of the clear trend in the currency, and the currency doubled. And at the same time, massive outsized demand for commodities. And that was as the result of China entering the global economy through the WTO, the revitalization of interest in emerging markets, and we just had this huge global bull market. So, and of course, those markets did way better than Wall Street. Over the same period, we should just remind ourselves that there was a secular bear market underway on Wall Street. So let's just zoom out again and look at what was happening there. Between 2000 and about 2013, the S&P 500 went nowhere. And at the same time, the dollar was going down. So, if you were, and let's just for the sake of comparison, redenominate it into Brazilian real. Well, let's take out the spike that we have, and then just look at the fact that between 2000 and 2013, as a Brazilian investor, you made nothing at all. by investing in the USA, and you could have made at 20 times your money by investing at home. So this is obviously a very important question. What happens to the US dollar? Well, then let's just look at the dollar index. So we have a short-term oversold condition. Let me put that back into local currencies. So we have a short-term oversold condition. We've had a meaningful contraction over the course of the last 4 months, and it's back in the region of the upper side of this underlying trading range. So it's not at all beyond the bounds possibility that we get at least some pause and consolidation here. Now, the next, that's just purely from technicals. It could easily push back up towards 105 and still remain in a downtrend. Now, let's just think about some of the fundamental factors. Spending in the USA is not yet under control. Now, definitely going to have more conversations. There's lots of people on Wall Street talking about how infantile politicians are and that this whole debt ceiling issue is completely nonsensical and no other country does it. But what it does help to do is focus attention on spending. And the US government still has emergency powers in place for outsized spending. And there was a really significant amount of money printed during the pandemic. That afforded the opportunity to companies to refinance. And one thing that we've definitely seen is that high yield spreads are starting to roll over. And then the spread between very high yield and less high yield, the CC minus B spread, is also rolling over. But the spending's not yet under control at the government level. So that's in the future. And it's either going to result in higher taxes or lower spending or a bit of both. And in order for that to occur, there's going to have to be some kind of bipartisan agreement. The USA started restricting spending yesterday, and the absolute limit of the debt ceiling will be reached at some point in the summer. Between now and then, we're going to have a massive uptick in political rhetoric. Eventually, some kind of deal will be met. But the bigger issue is that both parties have been responsible for outsized spending. And this isn't over yet. So the debt ceiling will eventually be raised. It is only really a question of what are the conditions that are reached before that happens. And then there are these huge unfunded liabilities, and there are pensions that are managed by people that are not financial professionals. And that's certainly the case in many of the unions. So there's obviously risk in the size of the debt burden, in the fact that the US government is spending like a drunken sailor, and that the dollar is coming down. In order for the dollar to find support, then they're going to have to do something about spending. And at the moment, at least, there's the potential that that might be the case because of the Freedom Caucus sharing a lot of the swing of power that the Tea Party movement had in 2011, 12, 13, and 14. So it's certainly something to pay attention to. If the dollar does begin to strengthen up and through the 200-day moving average, that would be rather meaningful. And it would certainly be an event that would detract from the bullish case for equities internationally. But as long as the dollar is deteriorating, then growth everywhere else in asset prices should be bolstered by the appreciation of local currencies. So the European stock market, the Euro Stoxx index, is now bouncing really rather emphatically from the region of the 200-day moving average. It has broken its medium-term downtrend, and we're coming back up into the region of the peaks from 2007. And this index has been going sideways for a very long time. And if the euro continues to appreciate, then we are going to see some additional foreign flows coming through. Now, it's also worth highlighting that the PE is around 13 and a half, and the yield is about 3%. So then just contrast that with the S&P 500, where the PE is more like 18 and the yield is 1.7%. Now, let's look at the Europe stocks index. So this is all of Europe. And now we have a better performance. We've got the stock market index that has been basically going sideways until 2021, then it broke out, and then subsequently found support in the region of the upper side of that underlying trading range. So this is including the UK, Switzerland, Norway, Sweden, and Denmark. If we look at the FTSE 350, then we're presented with a reasonably similar pattern. And in fact, it outperformed in 2016 and 17. And then subsequently, we're now right back in the region of the all-time peaks. From the perspective of a UK investor, someone who was buying all the way through the late 1980s and through to 2000, well, they really haven't got much to show for it since 2000. So they've had two alternatives. They could have invested in smaller companies, and the FTSE 250 is also rebounding here. It had a much deeper decline in 2022, but it is now testing the region of that 1,000-day moving average, but it is miles away from the peak in 2007 or from back in 2000. So very clear longer-term outperformance from smaller cap companies. But the reality is that most UK investors have property. So when we think about the UK property price, well, it's gone up a lot. And I'm trying to find a I'm trying to find a an a nominal price. There we go. Not a year over year price. I do apologize. So here's the price for the this is London house prices. And they've been trending higher for most of the last 23 years and are now looking a little bit overbought relative to a 5-year moving average. Now, it's also worth reminding ourselves that there have been plenty of times when prices haven't gone up. And they didn't go up a lot between about 2017 and 2020. And then they popped on the upside again. We can see that there have been multiple occasions when it has pulled back into the region of the moving average. And I would hazard a guess that there's a strong likelihood London property prices will also revert to the mean on this occasion. And that's particularly true if interest rates continue higher. Now let's think then about the potential here. If the pound continues to appreciate against the dollar, if the relative valuation of the UK stock market is attractive, and then that property prices no longer represent the most attractive asset, well, then the potential is that stocks will do better. And of course, the UK is a very internationally oriented market. So then there's the scope that the FTSE 100, which is the large cap portion of the market, will be able to push up and out of this exceptionally lengthy range. Now let's look at emerging markets. So the MSCI Emerging Markets ETF is exceptionally heavily weighted to China. So it looks almost identical to the H-share index. It did exceptionally well between 2003 and 2008, and then has subsequently basically gone nowhere. So we're looking at 16 years where there have been paltry returns. Now, that doesn't mean that there haven't been returns. There have been significant counter trend moves. So when you get big declines, you get big rebounds, and it can go from 30 to 50, or it can go from 30 to 60. And that happened in the space of less than a year. But in order to get a trending environment, we're going to need something else. We're going to need clear underperformance in the larger cap developed markets. We're going to need the dollar to trend lower. And we're going to need a clear growth story from the emerging markets. Well, China entering the global economy was a big growth story. So then the bigger question right now is, what's the big growth story for the emerging markets over the next decade? Well, let's think about what that could be. The one thing that emerging markets have more than anyone else is people. So when we look at the fact that the Chinese economy saw its population contract, and I've personally met multiple people in China, particularly my wife's, Mrs. Tracy's old classmates, and many of them have simply decided not to have children. And there have been a range of reasons, whether it is the cost, or they don't particularly, they're big fans of the communist administration. They wouldn't want to do that to their children. There's lots of reasons, but the reality is that the number of her compatriots who actually have children is comparatively small. Whether they're willing to talk about the decision not to have children or not, they just haven't had children. So then, obviously, that is a major problem in terms of demographics. And the Chinese workforce is going to contract. Well, then there's obviously an opportunity, because manufacturing has to happen somewhere. And a lot of manufacturing is still very labor intensive. So obviously then somewhere else is going to pick up those jobs. And then China will also end up importing more, because they're going to have lots of manufacturing domestically, but they're going to be less competitive because a vibrant consumer sector is going to be more demand heavy. So then that's obviously going to create opportunities. And well, India is obviously one of the big contenders. And a good part of the reason for that is they've got 600 million people that are under the age of 25. And that's a huge young workforce. And the one thing that I think everyone around the world is waking up to is that you absolutely need to have improving standards of governance. And this was, I think, brought home most acutely when I was in Saudi Arabia last week, that they have basically decided they're going to be the governance leaders of the region. And together with the UAE, they're going to start enforcing governance standards in their neighborhood. So this is starting with Egypt. And it's also going to extend into Pakistan. So until quite recently, whenever any country got into trouble in the Islamic world, then they could rely on a bailout from Saudi Arabia and the UAE. And money was deposited into their accounts. They allowed them to stabilize their currencies for a while, and they never really had to reform. And then when Egypt went for an IMF bailout shortly after the Sisi government took over, the understanding was they would float their currency, that they would open up the economy, they would reduce the ownership of assets by the military. They didn't do any of that. And now with the pandemic killing the tourist sector, with fewer remittances coming from overseas because of economic difficulties, and then the spike in grain prices because of the war in Ukraine, you have a trifecta of difficulties assailing the market. They've gone cap in hand again to Saudi Arabia and the UAE and have been told, well, yeah, we'll give you money, but we're going to want assets in return. So basically, they're going to have to sell some of their state assets, and it's other countries are going to be buying them. And this is a huge change. So the Egyptian pound is still devaluing, and they don't really yet have significant positive real interest rates, despite the fact that the interest rate has gone up a lot already. So I do think that there is the scope here for an additional leg lower, but ultimately they will have to embrace the change in governance because the big brothers that were constantly bailing them out aren't doing it anymore. And they are also talking about imposing the same kinds of governance rules on Pakistan. So that's also something that's worth considering. That over the course of the last decade, we haven't seen a big trend of governance improving. The big changes for India happened in the aftermath of the Gulf War. Remittances from the Middle East evaporated, and it caused a budget crisis. And that forced an opening up of the economy. And now, with the pandemic and with the traditional sources of liquidity drying up for countries, then we're going to see an additional budgetary crisis for these countries, and they're going to be forced to embrace better governance. And this is happening at exactly the same time that China is aging out of mass manufacturing. Now, it doesn't mean that China is not going to still be a major manufacturing sector, but for any new investments in manufacturing, well, why would you go to China where you're going to have to compete for labor? Why not go to a large population country with lots and lots of young people and set up a factory there? Places like Egypt, where the population has gone up by 10 million in less than a decade, they have 110 million people, and they sit on top of the Suez Canal. Well, with the right set of and close proximity to Europe and to the Middle East, then why on earth isn't the Egyptian economy a manufacturing powerhouse? So obviously the answer has to lie in terms of governance. Well, if reform were truly imposed, then that could actually happen. But it's going to be a bit of a show me kind of situation. But what we can think of is that there will be governance champions in this new decade. And of course, I think the first place to start looking at is the places where governance really is already starting to improve. Well, India is beginning to embrace better economic governance. And the stock market there is continuing to hold in the region of the all-time peak. But also, let's just put that into perspective and redenominate it. So, if we redenominate it into US dollars, it's firming from the region of the 200-day moving average. And then, if we put it into pounds, it is firming also from the upper side of that underlying trading range. Then, for an Australian investor, it's also firming. So, we see evidence of firming in a broad spectrum of currencies. Now, the other point is that India is on the expansionary side of its credit cycle. So, that's also positive for asset prices. And Reliance Industries and the, we might just simply regard them as the autocracy within India, continues to be exceptionally globally minded. So India is also basically cornering the market for outsourcing, and Tata Consultancy is now steadying as well from the region of its lows. I'm going to put this back into local currencies. So there is certainly the potential that India is going to pick up some of the slack from China over the course of this decade. But right now, what we have is China outperforming. And that's because it's coming off of such a low ebb. So the H-share index came all the way back down to test the region of the lows from 2008. It's been ranging for the last 14 years, and it's rebounding from the lower side of that range. If valuations in Europe are competitive relative to the USA, they're downright cheap in China. And you've got a PE of 5.75 and a yield as well of about 3.4. And that is despite the fact that the market has rebounded. China, for the present time, is engaged in a credit stimulus. So we can look at the credit impulse. And it has begun to contract. It's unlikely to get back up to the peak in 2016 or 13. But it does take time for that credit impulse that began really at the beginning of 2022 to feed through into the economy. And now that they have abandoned the COVID zero policy, that's very beneficial for the stock market. And then it's beneficial for consumption. So when we think about some of the better performing companies in Europe, many of them are benefiting from China opening back up. LVMH, for example, pushed on to a new high last week. Now it is overbought in the short term, but this has been a phenomenal advance over the last 7 years. And very much tied to the rise of the wealthier portion of the middle class in China. As China attempts to stimulate its economy, then that's likely to be beneficial for lots of assets. Now, the Bloomberg Commodity Index has pulled back over the last 6 months. It is beginning to steady. But it's also worth just highlighting the fact that this index is reweighted quite regularly. So while the CRB index has a bigger weighting in oil, the largest weighting in the BCOM is gold, and it's currently at 14%. Now, if you want to add together NYMEX and Brent, you're going to get a larger weighting. But not a lot bigger. Now let's look at that CRB index, and you get a similar pattern, although I think you do get a better performance from the CRB. I don't think we're going to get the weightings, and we don't. I don't have access to the continuous commodity index, which was equal weighted, because since it was bought by Refinitiv. But certainly, oil prices have been quite steady, and we're at also a rather interesting juncture here. The oil price has firmed from the region of the 1,000-day moving average and the upper side of the underlying trading range. And prices have been going sideways for really quite a long time. The big change in the energy markets is that the USA is now an exporter. And that has been a spectacular change in the last decade. Nobody believed David and I when we started predicting that in 2012. And now that it is a reality, I don't think people quite comprehend how much of a change that is. But the notion that the US government is now willing to support prices around $70 should give us all the information we need that the USA is now an exporter and they have a vested interest in ensuring that prices do not get too cheap. Lots of US consumers, they don't like seeing gasoline prices above $4. So prices are below $4 in most of the country right now. And we'll likely see some measures to depress prices when they get up to around that level. But a range between about $3 and $4 would probably suit the US government just fine. And they're basically behaving like an OPEC member and trying to support prices and trying to moderate prices when they get out of hand because it might impact economic growth and therefore the demand for oil. So this is a really big change and it's likely to persist. So the US government is now the equivalent, although not a member of OPEC, the equivalent of a member of OPEC. And that means that oil prices are likely to stay somewhat higher for longer. Well, that is an impediment to growth. It suggests that there will be alternatives. And obviously, when we think about the long term, then the positive net gain from fusion experiments in December is a really phenomenally positive development. The wrinkle, of course, is that they got net positive gain from an experiment that is not the same as the one that they're building in the south of France. They used concentrated laser beams for the National Ignition, I'm not going to get the name right, it's the Lawrence Livermore facility in California. And the tokamak that they're building in the south of France uses massive magnets to contain the plasma. Well, everyone thought that it was the tokamaks would get to net gain first. And the reason that they're building that is because they think that that would be the easier one to turn into a power plant eventually. And it's also what companies are betting on in terms of fuel and in terms of cycles. Well, when we think about the outlook for fusion, well, it could be at least a decade before we get a working reactor. And by the time we get the first commercial reactor, well, our reactor is built, we could be looking at about 30 years. And that is on the most bullish forecast for the for the development of that technology. Over the course of the next decade, a lot of countries are going to make decisions about what to do with energy. Well, Doosan Enerbility is a major South Korean industrial that focuses on the provision of nuclear equipment. They've signed deals with Saudi Arabia for their smart reactor, signed deals with NuScale to supply the components for its small modular reactors, and also has signed deals with Rolls-Royce to supply them with the components for their small modular reactor factory. And then they're currently looking at sites to build that in the UK. They estimate building at least 16 small modular reactors. And NuScale successfully signed a deal with Poland and Romania to supply small modular reactors. And the first of those was sold to a mining company. And let me see if we can find that. So it's KGHM are going to be the first customer for that small modular reactor. But the more important point is that NuScale was able to successfully argue that they don't need as much space as a conventional nuclear power plant. And that because of that regulatory change, they'll be able to place those small modular reactors on the same areas as coal-fired power stations. So they're not going to deliver the first one until 2029. And after that, the potential for ramping up production can happen quite quickly because they're going to be built on conveyor belts, or they'll be built on production lines, I think, to be more accurate. So that's obviously a positive, but we're still at least 6 years out from that. Between now and then, there's still going to be a lot of demand for energy. Now, in the last week, Shell announced that they're going to buy Volta. Volta is an interesting little company that they were planning on developing a business model that was going to offer free electricity in return for watching their advertising while you were charging your car. Well, that's not going to happen, at least not with Volta right now. Shell, on the other hand, has decided that they're going to buy their 3,000 charging stations. That will certainly help their green credentials, their decarbonization credentials, and allow them to continue pumping gas, which is their primary business. And the share is still in the region of the upper side of what has been a phenomenally lengthy range. And the yield is now around 3.5% and starting to improve once more after being shaved during the pandemic. So energy is likely to be an interesting place for the foreseeable future. And I don't think I'm quite on the same page as people who think that oil prices are going to go up to $150 or $200. But in a global recovery environment for emerging markets, then the oil price can appreciate. And I didn't want to put up C, I wanted to put up CVX because Chevron is now right in the region of its all-time peak and steadying. So we're going to see more infrastructure development because manufacturing has to migrate away from China. And it will go to places where infrastructure doesn't exist. And that's going to be places like India. Governance is improving also in places like Saudi Arabia. And Saudi Arabia is on the cusp of permitting at the beginning of a venture exchange. And that would be a massive change for the region. The regulator there is not accustomed to companies that don't make profits. And they would really consider traditionally a company that doesn't have profits as a gamble. So they've never been permissioned. But Saudi Arabia is very keen on attracting inward investment and deploying its assets in a productive manner. So they're going to open a venture exchange next year. And in that regard, they're going to try and compete with major capital markets for resources like the UK, Australia, and Canada. So there's certainly positioning underway to service the global economy in terms of mining. And the big challenge for mining has been the reluctance of investors to supply mines with funds. And there have been all of these questions about ESG and mining companies trying to justify themselves to their domestic populations. Well, what we're increasingly seeing is that emerging markets have the financial resources to sponsor mine development themselves. And then there's the fact that the Nubian Shield is comparatively less explored. And there hasn't really been a lot of mining there for 100 years. So all the way across the Sahel in North Africa, through the Arabian Peninsula and into the Caucasus is a new large mining destination, which Saudi Arabia wants to try and be the leader in. So this certainly is helping to support mining companies. Now, let's just then take a step back and look at the industrial metal miners. And the LME Metals Index has popped on the upside, and it is now recovering once more. And that is being led by first by copper. Copper prices were quite volatile this week, initially popping on the upside, then giving it up entirely on Wednesday, then coming back a bit yesterday and improving a bit in here today. There's copper in every piece of the supply chain for renewable energy, and that is most particularly true for wind turbines. And wind turbines continue to get bigger, and China is building some of the largest right now because the pickup in production of energy relative to the cost of putting one up, then the economics get better the bigger the turbines are. So there's certainly money flowing into this sector, but the ETF has been pausing over the course of the last week. If it can hold the region of the 200-day moving average, well, then it will have broken what's effectively a 2-year downtrend. But of course, that also is going to be very much tied to the bond markets. When we think about the 10-year yield, it's steadying right now from the region of the 200-day moving average. And interest rates are potentially now approaching a peak, with the USA starting to reduce the number of basis points they're raising by at subsequent meetings. And I think preparing the market right now for a 25 basis point hike in February. With the reduction in the size of the Fed's balance sheet, The most likely scenario is that we get a deflationary shock and that inflationary pressures moderate quickly. And that will have a knock-on effect for the US economy. And it will also have a knock-on effect for the most over-levered portions of the market. And I'm very much of the opinion that it is companies like Blackstone are some of the riskiest out there. And that is despite the fact that it has just about halved over the course of the last year. Now, the wider private equity sector is starting to recover. It's not like every one of the private equity companies is going to have the same problem. But we are certainly seeing that some are underperforming and doing so in a rather profound manner. So the listed private equity ETF in the UK has at least been going sideways for 6 months, and it's testing the region of the 200-day moving average. I do think that there is a clear risk in terms of leveraged loans, but leveraged loans are not going down. And that is, I think, something that is certainly helping to stoke investor interest right now. The total return on these bonds was at really close to a new all-time high in here this week. So there is certainly demand for, or we're back in something approaching a risk-on environment in the high-yield sector. When yields are objectively around 4%, then the spread of high yield at 475 basis points over a 4% yield, then that's going to be attractive to a lot of investors. So the high yield spread is back in the region of the 200-day moving average, and the CC minus B option adjusted spread is also back in the region of the 200-day moving average, but that has been a meaningful contraction, 150 basis points contraction in the space of about 5 or 6 months is a big move. And we're in this rather interesting environment because the high yield bond spread is contracting. The 10-year yield is still steady. What I find especially interesting right now is that the inverse correlation between the performance of bonds and equities is back in effect, whereas they were moving in tandem for most of 2022. They're now no longer moving in tandem. And then the yield curve spread is down to negative 69 basis points. Now, it was a little steadier in here today, but the reality is that it is at the lowest level that it has been at since the early 1980s. So we have increasingly tight monetary conditions. Money supply growth has basically leveled off. We're now at effectively zero. So it's also worth reminding ourselves that we haven't seen that since 1995. So these are definitely difficult times and in terms of the monetary aggregates. And we're in an environment where growth in earnings has not yet rolled over. Lots of the big technology companies are cutting back on employment. Google fired 12,000 people today, and that was certainly a support for the market. I think that we're in an environment where we can expect volatile movement. And not every company is going to have the same amount of volatility. The VIX index is right in the region of the lows over the last year, and it was up and down this week. I was stopped out of my short in the NASDAQ 100, but that was it was a reasonably tight stop. And my hunch at the beginning of the year was that we were due an oversold rally. And I was a bit nervous about holding on to my long in an environment where we still have inverted yield curves. So I had a reasonably tight stop. But there is the potential that we see stronger action from stock markets because we might have inverted yield curves and almost negative money supply growth, but earnings haven't really rolled over yet. Now, it doesn't mean they won't. I think it's very strongly likely that they will eventually roll over. But until earnings roll over, then investors are going to continue to give the benefit of the doubt to the upside, and they'll be wishing to buy the dip because valuations have improved because prices came down so much. And Bitcoin's rebound is a very clear indication that we're seeing more appetite for risk. Now, we are only about 15 months away from the halving, and it's quite normal to see Bitcoin bottom about a year before the halving. So we're kind of in the area where it should be bottoming around now. Now, we can also remind or just think about the fact that it's usually before, right before the halving, you get a wobble. And after the halving, that's when the really big advance comes. So there's going to be volatility over the course of the next year. But it's coming off of a very deep decline, coming down from almost 70 to about $16,000 is a big move. So there's certainly the potential for a rebound, and certainly the potential that some of these way, and I will talk a little bit about precious metals, but I think that the performance of Silvergate is rather interesting. The share came from 100 to about 10 in the space of 5 months, and they announced earnings during the week, and they lost $1 billion. But it's a crypto lender that still exists, and they weren't levered in any of the altcoins. They were using, or they were issuing loans in Bitcoin, or they were issuing loans for deposits of Bitcoin. With Bitcoin prices starting to improve, then some of these Bitcoin platforms and leveraged investments are also going to start to attract interest, and they have come off of exceptionally low levels. Now, when we think about the potential for the dollar to decline, then gold is an obvious beneficiary. Now, the price today was in mildly negative territory, but it is really quite overbought and coming up into the region of the peaks from 2020 and 2022. So I think it is quite likely that we're going to get some pause and consolidation. I'll be more than willing to buy the dip, but I'm not putting more money into gold when it is this overbought. And I do think that when it has consolidated, the most likely scenario is it will break above the 2000 level and then rally. And silver at this stage in the cycle should outperform gold. And it's not been firing in the same way as gold, but it was in positive territory today and steadying in the region of $25, but not quite yet above it. But if gold breaks on the upside, then silver will do substantially better. And It will probably not be very long before it takes out the all-time peak from 2011, because it is a much more volatile asset overall. So we're certainly at an interesting juncture for asset prices. It doesn't mean that we're not going to have a recession. There's certainly going to be a recession. And I think that it will fall most heavily on private assets and pensions in the USA. And the pressure that that's going to put on the US dollar is likely to benefit emerging markets and other developed markets. It's also likely to put upward pressure on commodity prices because of dollar weakness. But the big question over the long term is going to be about inflation and the willingness of central banks to put money in the pockets of consumers is going to be heavily tested by the upcoming recession. If they follow the playbook they've been following for the last decade and double the size of their balance sheets, then inflation is certainly going to become entrenched. If they cut interest rates too aggressively during the recession and leave them down for too long, inflation will become entrenched. If, on the other hand, we move into a more volatile environment where they cut interest rates but start raising them again faster, that we might get control of inflation. But asset prices will have a more difficult time. And then the clear growth trajectory of emerging markets will become much more attractive. And I suspect that that is the more likely scenario as we head into the next decade. And I think with that, I'll leave you for today, and I'll wish all the best.